Well, hello. Congratulations to you all for being able to find us, the spot in the basement. Welcome to the program of the International and National Security Law Practice Group. I'm Vince Witkowski. I'm the chair emeritus of this section. And I have a limited role, and that's to introduce our distinguished moderator, Judge Chad Radler. He's a clerk in the Sixth Circuit for Judge Norris. He spent 10 years as a partner at Jones Day in the trial and appeal justice issues and appeals department. He was in the last administration at DOJ. He was the acting assistant attorney general for the civil division. And he was confirmed to the Sixth Circuit himself in 2019. With that, I'll turn it over to Judd.
Vincent, thank you very much. I appreciate the introduction. One thing you didn't hear was much expertise in foreign policy. So I will do my best to guide our speakers, but they're the real experts today. And this is a really timely talk, given all that's happening in Ukraine and the surrounding area. So before I start, I have to give the CLE announcement. For those of you who are pursuing CLE, you need to sign in each day to receive credit, and that is done by the QR code. If you are pursuing CLE and you have not checked in, please be sure to scan the QR codes that you should have handed at registration, or feel free to grab a QR code from one of our volunteers who will be in the aisles. If you already checked in via the QR code, however, there's no need to recheck in. So with that, I want to just make one preliminary comment, and then we'll turn to our panel. I want to congratulate the Federalist Society on its 40th anniversary. I can't claim to have been involved with all 40 years. Like Justice Barrett mentioned last night, that she was in grade school when the Society was founded, so was I. I was founded about 10 years before the Society, so I didn't, at age 10, did not have much insight, but I have about 30 years of experience and expertise with the Society. I became a law student in 1994 in the fall, but I actually learned of the Federalist Society about 6 months before that. My senior year of college at the University of Michigan, I volunteered and then later worked on a U.S. Senate campaign for Spencer Abraham. And you should all recognize that name because he is one of the co-founders of the Society and the founder of the Harvard Journal of Law and Public Policy. Working on his staff, of course, you become very familiar with the candidate and their bio. He was very distinguished, Harvard Law School, former party chair of the Republican Party of Michigan, deputy chief of staff to Vice President Quayle. But there's this one little item at the bottom of his resume that I, for the life of me, could not figure out what it meant. It stated that he was the co-founder of the Federalist Society. And as a non-lawyer at that point, not even a law student, I had no idea what the Federalist Society was. And I tried in my mind to figure out what in the world this could be. A few years before that, there was a hit movie called The Dead Poets Society. And I thought maybe this is sort of a parallel to that movie, something like The Dead Framers Society. But over 30 years, I've learned the joke is on me. This is actually a robust and extremely successful organization, and it's been a real privilege to be involved with the group and today to moderate this discussion. So thank you for coming. So the war in Ukraine constitutes the latest in a series of incidents since the end of the Cold War in which Russia has sought to reassert authority over former Soviet states. In this case, as it has in the past, the Kremlin has offered a familiar series of purported legal justifications pertaining to the right of self-determination of peoples and allowable exceptions to international law's prohibition on the use of force. Soon after the invasion began, observers pointed to evidence of grievous war crimes committed by the Russian military. In March of 2022, the UN General Assembly voted overwhelmingly to condemn Russia's invasion of Ukraine as in violating Article 2 of the UN Charter. But now, more than 9 months later into the conflict, many questions remain. How should we address Russia's claims? What are Ukraine's options? How does this impact the international legal order and security policy going forward. Although our discussion is focused on international law, broader foreign and defense policy considerations will also be addressed by our panelists. We're going to speak down the dais here, so let me introduce all of our speakers. Our first speaker today is Professor Angela Stent. She will help us discern the Kremlin's underlying objectives in invading Ukraine. Professor Stent is director of the Center for Eurasian, Russian, and East European Studies and professor of government and foreign service at Georgetown University. Previously, Professor Stent served at the National Intelligence Council as National Intelligence Officer for Russia and Eurasia. Next up will be Ambassador Marshall Billingsley, who formerly served as Special Presidential Envoy for Arms Control. In that capacity, he led arms control negotiations on behalf of the United States government. Ambassador Billingsley has deep experience in arms control and broad experience in foreign policy and national security. And today he will bring us up to speed on Russia's recent actions on the ground, as well as offer an analysis of our own policy decisions, particularly our aid to Ukraine and the effectiveness of our current sanctions against Russia. Then I will call on Major General Charles Dunlap. General Dunlap joined the Duke Law Faculty in July 2010, where he's currently a professor of the practice of law and executive director of the Center of Law, Ethics, and National Security. General Dunlap retired from the Air Force in June 2010 after a 34-year career in the Judge Advocate General Corps. General Dunlap will help us understand how the international legal framework can respond to these events, as well as what precedent Russia's actions, as well as our subsequent responses, will affect the international community going forward. And finally, I will call on Mr. Michael Allen. Mr. Allen previously served as the Majority Staff Director of the House Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence, and before that, in the Bush White House. Mr. Allen is currently the Managing Director of Beacon Global Strategies, an advisory firm that focuses on international policy and security issues. And he will contend that assisting Ukraine is in the United States' national interest, and will explain why that is so. Each of our speakers will have up to 8 minutes. There's no formal red light, but I'll encourage you to stick roughly to that time, only so we have lots of time then for dialogue amongst the panelists, a question or two from me, and of course, question from our audience. So with that, Professor Stent.
Thank you very much. I'm delighted to be on this panel. Full disclosure, I am not a lawyer, but my daughter is a lawyer, so I'm fully briefed on the Federalist Society. So I was asked really to set the kind of background to this, the broader picture where we are today in this war in Ukraine. So the first issue that the organizers wanted me to address is why Putin launched this unprovoked aggression against Ukraine. And the official reasons keep changing. So every week there's nearly a different reason. They range from denazifying Ukraine. And you have to understand when the Russians say that Ukrainians are Nazis, they mean that they don't want to be part of Russia and therefore they must be Nazis. And so they make this analogy, you know, to World War II, which is completely untrue. So denazifying Ukraine, then protecting the rights of the citizens in the Donbas region, and I'm sure that's what the international law specialists will talk about. Demilitarizing Ukraine, that was a goal at the beginning of the invasion. And now it's de-Satanizing the country. Now we are told that Ukraine is a Satanist country backed by the Satanist United States. And so that there's now all this religious imagery that goes with it too. Anyway, the real reason, of course, why Russia invaded Ukraine is that Putin and his associates have never accepted the collapse of the Soviet Union as a legitimate and even legal, and Putin has said that it's questioned the legality of the way that the Soviet Union collapsed. And so he has been determined to relitigate the settlement that was arrived at the end of the Cold War, and to reverse really the Soviet breakup. And he's likened himself to czars in the past, like Peter the Great, Catherine the Great, that gathered in lands, neighboring lands that Putin claims belong to Russia. And of course, he's written this 5,000-word essay last year saying that Ukraine and Russia are one country, blaming Lenin for the fact that the Ukrainians think they have a right to have their own state or their own national identity, because he says Lenin did this, created the Ukrainian Soviet Socialist Republic to give Ukrainians the idea that they had some right to this. So there are all of these strange justifications for this. But the real reason is to subjugate Ukraine. And when the Russian troops invaded, the idea was that they would take Kyiv in 3 to 5 days and that they would have a puppet government there that would be pro-Russian. Zelensky would flee and they would then begin the process really of eradicating Ukrainian national identity. And we're going to talk, I'm sure, a lot about the military aspects of this, but there's a cultural aspect. I mean, just today, reading what they've done, the Russians, when they've left Kherson, the major city that the Ukrainians have now liberated, the Russians have taken, you know, countless priceless cultural artifacts from Kherson, as they've done in many of the other cities. So it's really trying to eradicate an entire national identity as well as subjugate Ukraine. Now, given the poor performance of the Russian military compared with the impressive performance of the Ukrainian military, obviously largely because of the assistance that we, the United States, and some of our NATO allies have given them, Putin's goal of conquering all of Ukraine seems very, very distant at the moment. Russia failed to capture Kyiv. It took Kharkiv, a major city in the east, but the Ukrainians have now taken that back. And then really the most impressive was the take back of the Kherson region and the town of Kherson. And you can go online and watch scenes of people dancing in the streets, welcoming the Ukrainian soldiers back, because this is also a lifeline to Crimea. It's part of what part of Russia's original goal to secure all the territory to the Crimean Peninsula, and then maybe even take Odessa as well. Now, the Russian army is in retreat, but of course we do know what Russia has been doing the last few weeks since its army has been so much in retreat, is the, you know, indiscriminate bombardment of civilian targets, depriving many cities in Ukraine, including Kyiv, of electricity, of water, threatening the nuclear power plant or almost shutting it down, really, in Zaporizhzhia. So these are not military targets that they're attacking. They are attacking civilian targets. And this is the way they're exacting revenge on the Ukrainians because of the really bad performance of the Russian military. Now, the next question I was asked to address is, where do we stand in terms of negotiations? And there are stories in the press today that General Milley has suggested that the Ukrainians should, quote unquote, cement their gains, that they should sit down at the table now with Russia and negotiate a settlement. This is not, I think, a view that's shared by most people in the Biden administration. And this is obviously quite a controversial subject when people talk about how this war might continue. We do know that there were negotiations in March and early April in Istanbul that were brokered by President Erdogan. And a few others as well. And the outline of those agreements would have been that the Russians would have withdrawn to where they were on February 23rd, the day before they invaded. The Ukrainians would have agreed that they would not seek to join NATO, and the Western powers would have given Ukraine fairly tough security guarantees to make sure that, you know, if there were another invasion, they would be defended. But those negotiations then foundered, partly because of the discovery of the atrocities at the Bucha suburb outside of Kyiv, and partly because the Russians really weren't that interested in negotiating at that point with the Ukrainians. And that was a previous template, but that would no longer, I think, be appropriate. I think the Russians have now, of course, annexed, quote unquote, four territories in Ukraine. To get them to agree to withdraw to where they were on February 23rd, I think would be a tall order. But the Ukrainians equally are not going to accept the loss of territory, particularly of these of the Kherson and Zaporizhzhia areas and the Donbas. Why should they? Because they're doing much better on the battlefield. And I think the other thing, when you talk about negotiations, you have to remember that the Russians have essentially violated every agreement that they signed with Ukraine since the Soviet collapse. And that includes the Budapest Memorandum in 1994, where Russia guaranteed Ukraine's territorial integrity and sovereignty in return for Ukraine giving up its nuclear arsenal, which at that point was the third largest in the world, and the treaty, 1997 treaty, which Boris Yeltsin signed, treaty of friendship with Ukraine, where again, Russia recognized the border of Russia and Ukraine as Ukraine's border and agreed to its territorial integrity. And therefore, to imagine how one would create conditions where you could sign an agreement with Russia that they would in fact honor, I think would really take some imagination. The Russians have said that they are willing to negotiate as long as Ukraine accepts their terms. This they said as recently as last week, but we don't know what these terms are anymore. Zelensky, of course, a couple of weeks ago said that he wouldn't negotiate as long as Putin was in power. But I think with a little pressure from the United States and other Western countries, he has walked that back and said he would be willing to negotiate, providing that the conditions were right. But it doesn't seem that at the moment this is the time to negotiate with Russia, given unless at least it would stop the bombardments. But still, Zelensky, I think, is in no mood, and the people around him, to make any territorial concessions at the moment. The third question I was asked was, what are the best and the worst outcomes? Well, the best outcome clearly would be a total withdrawal of Russian troops from all of the areas that it's occupied in Ukraine since it annexed Crimea in February, March of 2014. That seems unlikely. The Crimean issue, I think, is particularly difficult. But at least I think the best outcome realistically would be Russia withdrawing from the Donbas region. It started this war in 2014, and Ukraine obviously would need an enormous amount of reconstruction assistance. I think the Russians should be somehow pressured into contributing towards that. But that would be, of course, from the Ukrainian point of view, the best outcome. But that would assume that Vladimir Putin, A, has given up his dream, his goal of subjugating Ukraine. And I think that's also very hard to imagine at the moment. Then I was asked about the worst outcome. Well, the worst outcome would clearly be that, you know, Russia refuses to negotiate, that Putin feels cornered, and that, in fact, it does escalate to the possible use of a tactical nuclear weapon. And, of course, if that happened, that who knows where that would stop. That could then escalate even further than that. I think this is something where Putin wants the Ukrainians and the rest of the world to believe that he might be serious, to intimidate people, to break Western resolve, to get the Ukrainians to put pressure on their own government to stop the war. I think those are all the reasons. I think you cannot dismiss these veiled threats from the Kremlin, but I think you shouldn't exaggerate them and be too intimidated by them. It's difficult to find a balance. What Putin is waiting for, and this will be my last point here, he is waiting not only for Ukrainian resolve to break, and we see no signs of that, but also for Western and transatlantic resolve to break. And that would be a combination of the outcome of the US midterms, and I know that Michael Allen is going to be talking about that, so I won't say anything else about that, but also the outcome of the winter in Europe. How many European countries, as they get into the winter and they face very high fuel costs, electricity costs, will say, you know, this is enough. The impact of the Western sanctions on us is unbearable, and we have to sit down with the Russians and lift the sanctions. We haven't seen very much sign of that yet. There have been some demonstrations in Europe, but so far the solidarity is holding. But that's certainly what Putin is waiting for as we go into this winter.
Sure. Thank you, Professor. Next up is Ambassador Billingsley.
Well, let me just add to what the professor had to say. Russia's serial treaty violator, regardless, I mean, not just when it comes to Ukraine, but with regard to any international accord that they sign. And we do need to keep that in mind as people call, I think, very wrongheadedly for negotiations at this time. So in June of 1961, John F. Kennedy had a summit in Vienna, Austria, with Nikita Khrushchev. And Khrushchev came to the summit believing that Kennedy was weak and that he was unprepared, in part based on his bungling of the Bay of Pigs. And he left convinced that Kennedy would not stand up to the Soviet Union, and he launched his plans to install nuclear weapons in Cuba. Almost 60 years later to the day, Vladimir Putin met with Joe Biden in Geneva. And whatever conclusions he reached from that meeting, it is clear that he decided that Biden would not stand up to Russia over Ukraine. And when Biden so badly bungled Afghanistan, the die was cast. I say this because the most important thing the administration can do right now is to change Putin's perception of Joe Biden as a weak and feeble leader. And that failing, we need to at least change his perception that we're not in it to win. And upon this, I think we will depend on the new incoming Republican majority in the House. Certainly, the fact pattern of this administration so far has, I think, reinforced Putin's conclusion that our determination to confront Russia, as the professor indicated, will ultimately falter and dissipate. Certainly, the way the Biden team folded on arms control negotiations over the New START treaty just days into office told the Russians that Biden doesn't understand or doesn't want to use leverage. The way Special Envoy Malley has been behaving in negotiations via the Russians with the Iranians on the JCPOA, I think has only solidified that impression. And of course, recent press reports that Jake Sullivan went to Kyiv to press Zelensky back to the negotiating table are sending all the wrong signals. The challenge we have, and what I'm hoping the new incoming Republican majority in the House will do, is to adopt a twofold approach. The first is a quintessential Republican approach, which is to bleed the Russians white. The arming Ukraine to bleed dry an invading Russian army is a very Republican thing to do. Ronald Reagan did it to the Soviets consistently until they withdrew from Afghanistan. And the Russians are bleeding out. General Milley yesterday or the day before indicated that the U.S. estimates of total casualties, that's wounded and killed, is north of 100,000. Of course, the Russians over 9 years in Afghanistan lost 15,000. So the losses on the Russian side, there have been many losses on the Ukrainian side too, comparable, but the losses are significant. And we need to double down. As Garry Kasparov has said, when your enemy is drowning, throw him an anchor, throw him an anvil. This administration has been moving in terms of supporting the Ukrainians with military aid, moving at the speed of shame. We learned on the night of the 24th that the White House lawyers had determined that providing further military assistance would make us a belligerent in the conflict. Luckily, that was rapidly reversed as the Hill learned about it and the hue and cry ensued. At the same time, they decided to completely restrict intelligence sharing, to deny anything that would be of battlefield utility, and to provide no information on what was going on in the Donbas region for fear, again, the White House lawyers that we would become party to the conflict. When it comes to the actual arming of the Ukrainians, they didn't want to supply javelins, then they did. They didn't want to supply Stingers. They ultimately did. Of course, our Baltic allies were the first to actually transfer the Stingers. They didn't want to supply Harpoons, but they finally did. They didn't want to provide the HIMARS launchers. Then they gave a few. Then they've given more. We all remember the fiasco over the Polish MiG-29s. They don't want to supply the ATACMS long-range missiles. They're being dragged into this, and the Republican House needs to press the administration to do more and provide more to support the Ukrainians. The Ukrainians just took back Kherson today. So they are moving forward, and with our continued support, they will progress to the point at which either they do liberate the remainder of occupied Ukraine or they set the conditions for a successful negotiation. The other thing that we need to do, and again, we will have to depend on the Congress because it will not come from this administration. And I say this, and I was actually dual-hatted, not only as the lead negotiator with the Russians, nuclear weapons, but also for a time as the Assistant Secretary of the Treasury for Terrorist Financing and Financial Crimes, which is the sanctions enforcement part of the Treasury. And I will tell you that the sanctions we've imposed on Russia today are haphazard, full of loopholes, and have been completely ineffectual in their stated goal. Joe Biden came on record and said, I'm going to reduce the ruble to rubble, is what he said. And that has just patently not happened. In fact, the ruble was one of the two best performing currencies this past year, strengthening against the dollar. When your European allies are funneling nearly $1 billion a day to Moscow in hard currency for energy purchases, how do we possibly think that the war effort on the part of the Russians is going to falter? We've learned that the Russians, in fact, flew bags of cash, euros in this case, to Tehran to acquire those UAVs, and now they're going to make additional flights to buy shorter range and medium range ballistic missiles. The Russians are flush with cash. And unless we're going to bring this fight to a speedy conclusion and not have it drag on for 9 years, then we need to get serious about sanctions. And that means, in particular, we need to get serious about sanctions on the Russian banks, who are currently explicitly exempted when it comes to energy trade. And we need to sanction the Russian oil and gas industry with secondary sanctions on anybody who chooses to violate that requirement and trade with the Russians, notwithstanding our view. That is going to be a tough and a tall order, and that involves really deciding for the first time to put some pressure on the Europeans. But we've got to do it. Otherwise, it does make little sense to continue to funnel hundreds of millions of U.S. taxpayer dollars to arm the Ukrainians while the Europeans are funneling hundreds of millions of dollars to arm the Russians. I would commend to you to go back and read any of a number of the annual speeches that Ronald Reagan gave on Afghanistan. And I'll just very quickly read to you the first of those that he issued in March of 1982. And every time you hear Afghanistan, just think Ukraine. Reagan proclaimed, in December 1979, the Soviet Union invaded Afghanistan without provocation and with overwhelming force. Since that time, the Soviet Union has sought through every available means to assert its control over Afghanistan. The Afghan people have defied the Soviet Union and have resisted with a vigor that has few parallels in modern history. The Afghan people have paid a terrible price in their fight for freedom. Their villages and homes have been destroyed. They've been murdered by bullets, bombs, and chemical weapons. One-fifth of the Afghan people have been driven into exile. Yet their fight goes on. The international community, with the United States joining governments around the world, has condemned the invasion of Afghanistan as a violation of every standard of decency and international law, and has called for a withdrawal of Soviet troops. Every country and every people has a stake in the Afghan resistance, for the freedom fighters of Afghanistan are defending the principles of independence and freedom that form the basis of global security and stability. Joe Biden is no Ronald Reagan, but it is my hope in the new Republican Congress, and I look to you, Mike, to tell us who that's going to be, but I hope we do come up with a Charlie Wilson, maybe not in lifestyle choices, but certainly in determination to fight the Russians. Thanks so much.
And that's a nice lead into General Dunlap.
Well, thank you very much, and I really appreciate this opportunity to speak here. What I'm going to try to do is I'm going to go through a number of different legal issues, international law issues, and law of armed conflict issues that have arisen in this conflict. I want to say at the beginning, there's no moral equivalency between Russians and Ukrainians. We know that. However, I would caution that we be very careful about what norms we allow to be established in this conflict, because we are so anxious to support the Ukrainians. Because the way international law works is the jus ad bellum, in other words, the rationale for going to war, it's a completely separate body of law from jus in bellum. And the reason for that is you don't, no matter how bad the person is who started it, you don't, you know, change what the law of war requires, because every belligerent thinks they're right. And, you know, it really is interesting, Professor. You mentioned that 5,000 word. You know what the Russians did? They had their official legal rationale is self-defense. And you have to file something with the UN. And they filed like three sentences. Then they said, see attached, and they attached that speech. And I did look at it, and I'm used to reading some really boring stuff, but I got to tell you, it's just all over the map. Professor, did you look at it? It is all over the map. But in any event, we did have a UN Security or UN General Assembly vote. 141 nations voted against the Russians. of 193. But keep in mind, we need to keep in the back of our heads that those 141 nations' populations only comprise 42% of the world's population. The nation, the governments representing the majority of the world's population either voted for the Russians, which is really only a handful. Most of them abstained, because once you got India and China not voting for it, you've got quite a few number of people. And here, I don't know if you remember, but in the Washington Post last March, there was a story about how the Ukrainians were distributing their military equipment in throughout their cities. In fact, the quote there was, the reporter found virtually every neighborhood in most cities has become militarized. And then later, you might have heard about Amnesty International, who actually accused them of Ukraine of war crimes. Because under the international law of war, you're supposed to separate military objects from civilian objects. But it was premature to charge anybody with war crimes, because as Mike Schmidt from the Naval War College, who wrote a really good, not rebuttal, actually better explanation, is there are reasons, valid reasons, that you can put civilian objects near military targets. Look where the Pentagon is, right? And so you can, but there are also requirements under Protocol 1 to the Geneva Convention that requires you, the defender, to take steps to protect your own population. So I, you know, more to find out on that, and I don't think, and I think Amnesty, and believe me, I am ready to believe Amnesty International screwed something up. It's, you know, somebody coming from the Air Force and just, you know, and I'm going to come back to that. Attacks on infrastructure. We are going, number one, that's part of our doctrine. We attack infrastructure. You know, Ukrainians attack probably the most important piece of infrastructure, which is Kerch Strait Bridge that Crimea depends upon. But things can be done lawfully or they can be done unlawfully. Electricity is typically one of our targets. And so as we analyze this, we've got to get down to the specifics, because we are looking at, we may find ourselves in a conflict with Russia, China, Iran, North Korea, where we may have to ourselves attack infrastructure targets. So I think we ought not to be painting with a too broad a brush, and especially electricity. There's a statement in the DoD Law of War Manual, the Obama-era Law of War Manual, that says normally electrical, you know, because of the value of electricity to a military capability, it's normally going to be a proper military objective. There are other factors you take into account. And so I think we need to be careful not to paint too broad a brush without defending what the Russians are doing, but just trying to understand what the law is here. There was not too long ago the killing of the Russian propagandist, and the Ukrainian special operations, they blew up her car. She was actually the daughter. A lot of people think that they're actually going after her father. And the U.S. did respond to it, according to the New York Times. I don't know how true this is, that American officials admonished Ukrainian officials over the assassination. Okay, you can kill individuals in wartime, and it's not necessarily assassination, and some of them might be civilians. But generally speaking, if somebody is a propagandist, no matter how revolting it is, it generally isn't going to be a lawful target. So we need to, there are times when a propagandist can be a target, when they're specifically calling for, like, genocide. In Rwanda, you might, there was a radio station that was doing that, and they eventually brought the test for it. We're now looking at, the Russians are threatening to attack satellites. And why is that? Because Elon Musk's Starlink system is being, the Ukrainian army depends upon it, the Ukrainian people depend upon it. And it's a very interesting question, because the targetability of satellites is probably one of the hot issues, because there are different ways you can do it. If you blow it up with a direct ascent missile and you put all this debris out, that's going to be an indiscriminate attack, because that can destroy, you know, hundreds of satellites. And in fact, in the Starlink system, we're talking about 3,000 to 4,000 satellites. So you probably can't even take it out with direct descent. So then you're looking at cyber means. The big issue in cyber right now is what actually constitutes an attack, because the Geneva Conventions in Protocol 1 were written at a time when an attack implied force or violence. Well, some cyber things don't exactly involve force or violence. So are they attacked? Do you have to even consider the proportionality analysis and how the effect on civilians and so forth? So that's another hot issue that's going on. The treatment of POWs, the UN has criticized both sides, but there's the scary thing about what's happening in Ukrainian POWs is that I think there's real issues with the Red Cross getting access to them. You don't really know where they are. They might have been taken back to Russia and so forth. So it very much is a concern what's happening to the Ukrainian POWs. Russian POWs, some of them have been reportedly abused by Ukrainians. This is the abuse of POWs on both sides is a big concern. But I think clearly, I'm personally much more concerned about what Ukrainian POWs and Russian hands. A couple of other things. There's been a lot of talk about amending the U.S. war crimes statute to permit what we call universal jurisdiction. Right now, to be prosecuted for a war crime under U.S. law, there has to be a U.S. perpetrator, a U.S. victim, takes place on U.S. territory. But the call is, well, we don't have any of that. We might want to prosecute some of these Russians. And the challenge, though, with that is, if somebody is tried in this court, they're going to be tried under American constitutional standards, which means things like discovery, things like pretrial publicity, things like due process could make it very complicated, because there are so many organizations in Ukraine right now gathering, trying to be helpful. I think it's going to be hard to sort all that out in a way that you can fulfill, if you're the prosecutor, the disclosures. Other people are concerned that, if we have universal jurisdiction, then other countries are going to, that's going to proliferate beyond the countries that do have it. And the U.S. is going, U.S. personnel are going to be subject to perhaps politicized charges. So I think we need to think that one through very carefully. We do have universal jurisdiction for piracy. And I think the last case of pirates that we did not too long ago didn't end well. So I think I personally think that the best solution is some sort of hybrid of Ukrainians and the international involvement, where you in very transparent process. International law, international criminal justice doesn't have the American requirements. Generally, there's no exclusionary rule because they don't have juries. They can appeal acquittals and so forth. It's a very different kind of system than ours, and it may be better for this particular situation. A couple other things that we need to think about, I would suggest, and we can get more into in the Q&A, is we talked a lot about the weapons transfers. We're going to have to be very careful. And I saw that the government has sent a team to Ukraine to make sure that they're tracking the weapons, because we don't want to end up in the same situation like we had in Afghanistan where the missiles escaped. But we also, how you hear about the military-industrial complex? My judgment is we need more military-industrial complex, because it was even surprising to me. We haven't built any Stinger missiles for almost 20 years. There is no factory to build them. They're going to have to build them, recreate them. We have like one factory that makes 155-millimeter shells, and I read somewhere they normally make about 14,000 a month. They're going to ramp that up to 35,000 a month. But in the Ukraine, they're shooting off, Ukrainians are shooting off 3,000 or 4,000 a day. Russians might be shooting off 6,000 or 7,000 a day. So the burn rate of these weapons, and especially precision weapons, is extraordinary. And it, and I read somewhere where if we went to war with China, we'd only have a couple weeks' worth of precision weapons. Europeans have pretty much emptied their inventories of precision weapons, which means that we'll go to dumb bombs, what we call dumb bombs. I mean, without the satellite, navigation, there's other navigation systems and weapons can use, but it is a concern. So if I were recommending, and in fact, I read this article from India, where a guy wrote, well, the Americans have sanctioned the Russians' microchips. Well, without microchips, they can't make precision weapons. Very good. That was offered as an excuse for indiscriminate bombing, because, well, if they had microchips, I don't know that the Russians would have worked really hard to be more discriminant in their attack with or without microchips. But it is, and one last thing I do want to mention, and this is something we all have to think about. Have you all heard of the Ukraine IT Army? What the Ukrainians did is they basically went out and told the whole world to conduct cyber operations against the Russians and Russian enemies. And they got a response. And there were all kinds of Russian entities, including civilian entities, that were targeted by the IT Army. So one of the big discussions in the Cold War world is, does that make those people direct participants in the conflict? Because a civilian normally is protected. But if a civilian directly participates in hostilities, then they become targetable and they lose their eligibility for POW status. But the big thing is they become targetable. And the Ukraine also has an app that they distributed to their population, which was mostly for, social security and stuff like that. But they modified it so that people could report the location of Russian troops, for targeting purposes. Well, if you look in our DoD Law of War manual, one of the examples of activity that turns a civilian into a direct participant is conveying tactical targeting information or serving as a lookout. So believe me, I want to see the Ukrainians win. I just don't want us to start establishing in the public's mind or the world's mind norms that really aren't demanded by international law, because we don't want to handcuff ourselves in a future conflict with North Korea, China, whoever, where we would have to go after these kinds of targets. And we can do it lawfully. I'm very much in favor of strict adherence to the law of armed conflict. But I don't know if you've been following, but this Pentagon has a new plan out called the Civilian Harm Mitigation Program, which is overlaying restrictive policies that are not required by the law of armed conflict. Everybody wants to protect civilians. But on the other hand, sometimes the best way to protect civilians is to kill the people who are doing most of the killing the civilians. And if you make it too cumbersome, then that is going to suffer. I wrote an article once, it's called The Moral Hazard of Inaction in War. John Stuart Mill said that, it's just as immoral. Inaction can be just as immoral as errant action. So in other words, and I'm finished there, but I just wanted to say there are a lot of international law issues percolating. And I think we really need to bear down and make sure they're resolved in a way that is consistent with international law, but also that we don't want to unnecessarily create norms and things that are going to blow back on us in the future.
Great. Thank you, General. And next up is Mr. Michael Allen.
Thank you, Judge. It's an honor to be here with you and my colleagues to talk about this issue. I was a member of the Federalist Society at the University of Alabama Law School, so it's a particular honor to be with this group today. I never practiced law for a day, but that won't stop me from trying to borrow an analogy from, I think, criminal law, which was the doctrine or the use of the phrase aggravating circumstances that I would say increase the culpability of a particular figure. So let me borrow that as a national security term, take you back to a world before February 24th, 2002, and list a series of factors. And I'd like you to think, of course, rhetorical question about whether this would require a very serious national security response from the United States of America. Imagine one of the two nations that we are in a geopolitical competition with, a new era since the end of the global war on terrorism, and that particular nation poisoned and used chemical weapons on its enemies overseas, its intelligence services engaged in murder in allied countries overseas. It interfered with elections. It destabilized the Middle East by backing a state sponsor of terrorism. And here I'm thinking of Syria. That has budding new friendships with another state sponsor of terrorism in Iran. One that has destabilized the security situation in Eastern Europe by invading, among others, at least two of its neighbors. A country that has weaponized energy, violated every treaty that we can think of, engaged in cyber attacks against the United States on our critical infrastructure, and certainly has looked the other way as criminals within its jurisdiction have run wild with ransomware attacks. Would this or would this not constitute, as we like to say, malign influence at very least? And wouldn't you have a strong foreign policy, national security policy just to confront or contain or to blunt this particular country on its own merits? I think you would. I think it's a very American type of response to enter into such a policy. But it is certainly the case that it's in our national interest here post February 24th to support Ukraine now that it's been invaded a second time by its neighbors. I know we're on the heels of an election here. This has gotten very emotional, certainly within the Republican Party among, you know, as we battle for the soul of the Republican Party between isolationists and people like me who seek a strong, assertive America in the world. But let me hearken again back to the geopolitical competition. Certainly China's number one, but Russia's number two. If someone told you a year ago that you could spend between $15 and $20 billion and completely ruin and break the Russian army without one American life, you'd probably say to yourself, that's a pretty good deal, especially considering how reckless this particular country is. A second reason why this is in our national interest to specifically support Ukraine is that Russia is a revisionist power that seeks to turn the clock back with China, by the way, to challenge the world that we built after World War II, a world built on freedom, economic openness, and democracies. This is something I think we hold dear as Americans, and a reason that I think it's in our national interest to move forward. This is the first geopolitical competition. Well, this is the first war of the geopolitical competition. And I think it's very, very important that we win this particular war. Let me talk a little bit about the election and the open question of where will the Republican Party be on assistance to Ukraine in the new Congress. First of all, you've heard the news. It wasn't quite the Republican tidal wave that many people expected, but the best people I'm talking to in town think it'll turn out to be a majority of 224, 225, 226. So it's going to be a very, very tight majority for Speaker McCarthy if he can make it there. He has been telling people for weeks that he needed a larger Republican majority than this so that he could freeze out people that tend to be against everything in the House Republican Conference. And I think some of his maneuverability will be constrained. Nonetheless, and I've got a piece in Politico coming out on this next week, but there are a number of reasons why I hope the Republican Party will return to its roots, the roots so eloquently outlined, of course, by Marshall Billingsley here. And there's several reasons, there's several things that I think can help get Republicans to support Ukraine. One, we need not run away from tough oversight. It's entirely appropriate for a new Republican majority in the House of Representatives to seek answers from the administration, to ask whether there's a plan to win, or even ask the Biden administration to be more forthcoming about what the end game might be that we seek as Americans as we look towards this war. This need not be considered a blank check. We can do tons of oversight over this particular issue, and we ought to embrace it. Number two, I think another way to help Republicans get there and remain there on Ukraine is that we need the Europeans to step up. The headlines in Europe are usually bad. It's usually about the European Commission failing to fund a mechanism to repay Eastern European countries who have transferred tanks and other weaponry to the Ukrainians. And lately at aid conferences, they're not really hitting their numbers on direct budget support to the Ukrainian government. We also need Germany to get more serious about its aid. It's the biggest economy. It's in Central Europe. It has a moral obligation to step forward. They've said the right things, but tanks speak louder than words, and the Germans need to really step up. Finally, let me say another word about China, and then I'll turn this back over to the moderator. You're starting to see an argument within the Republican Party that the real fight is with China, and that with every dollar we spend on Ukraine, or every moment we spend talking about Russia and Ukraine, is mindshare and money that's not going against the Chinese, who are a more formidable threat because of their economy and because of the military modernization that they've been in for at least 25 years. I am one that absolutely believes that the United States needs to take China very, very seriously in the economic domain, the diplomatic domain, and of course, militarily. I'm in the camp, just so you'll know, of not war, but deterrence by putting so many different weapon systems on the island of Taiwan that the Chinese dare not take the decision to do a cross-straits invasion. But I think it would help things if the Biden administration in their budget that comes out in February funds many of these initiatives to help Taiwan defend itself. I think that would comfort many in the Republican Party and frankly many in the country who are worried about the Chinese. If they knew we had a serious plan on Taiwan, I think they would be more likely to go ahead and support additional spending for Ukraine as they try and knock the Russians out of the box. By the way, last thing on Russia. When the Ukrainians are done with them, probably at the end of next year, as long as America continues to stand by them, this will be the least threatening that the Russians will be to NATO, at least since the collapse of the Soviet Union. So think about that. They have been rocked and routed so badly that I think we're going to be able to do a true pivot to Asia, take on the Chinese, deter the Chinese from taking Taiwan, if we go ahead and finish business here in Europe and get serious about funding our obligations in Asia. Thank you.
Great. So each of you may have a thought or two you want to share about something else, something your one of your co-panelists said. So we'll just start with Professor Stent. If you have a minute or two comments, welcome them. If not, you can pass down the road.
I think I'll just add to what Mike Allen was just saying, and that is the role of Europe in this. The Europeans have in many ways been free riding on this, and they have been reluctant to put their money where their mouth is. The Germans, I agree, have been have said that they were going to provide Ukraine with particularly the military hardware, and then they just haven't delivered. And that debate is still going on there, and I think I agree with you that I think going into next year, if the Europeans don't assume more of the burden for this, and also, you know, for the looking at the reconstruction of Ukraine, then I think it's going to be much harder to get a political consensus in this country to keep sending what we're sending to Ukraine.
You know, I actually intended to say happy Veterans Day. All of you who served.
I was a JAG officer.
we'll consider.
But thank you.
A couple of thoughts very briefly. One is that I believe we have no indication that munitions are walking in the Ukrainian context, but we definitely need to keep eye on it. And I think Pentagon is doing a pretty good job. The Ukrainians are well incentivized to maintain positive control over the inventories. Certainly, there have been some seizures and some losses because apparently that's precisely what the Russians flew to the Iranians are some steamers and things for exploitation. These things do happen in the field of battle. One of the things when the battle is now going to be joined in the lame duck session to push through additional funding to Ukraine, because we're not quite sure how Leader McCarthy is going to mobilize and maintain consensus, and this will be a significant debate for the heart of the Republican Party in the coming days. But I want to encourage you to understand that when you hear about these various amounts that are going to Ukraine, these numbers conflate at least three different types of activity. Okay, one is the drawdown of existing munitions that the taxpayer has already paid for, that are sitting in U.S. inventory. And the DoD did the right thing. Most of the munitions we transferred, at least at the outset, were set to expire on their shelf life anyway, and would have been demilitarized or excess defense article to some other country in any event. So keep that in mind, that these are the drawdown authorities is a bulk of this. But the second amount that you're hearing about is replenishment of inventory. And the general is exactly right. The lapse in Stinger production is crazy. And we are going to need these systems in a future Taiwan contingency. So there is a great deal of money that's going into replenishment of inventory. I'll come back to that briefly. The third is actually investment in the defense industrial base. Okay. So spending to get our production capabilities back to where they frankly should have been and need to be. As the Taiwan threat prior to 2027, I think, is significant. On inventory requirements, it's a valid point to be a little concerned, but I will tell you the Pentagon, I've been the Pentagon guy for most of my life, the planning requirements are static, and they do not take into account the massive attrition that has occurred to Russian forces. So the UCOM inventory levels are not being adjusted on the fly while the PACOM inventory levels remain static. So don't necessarily buy into the argument that we don't have enough for the Indo-PACOM theater. When you consider that if we keep going in the direction we're going, the Russian military, as Michael Allen has said, will be thoroughly gutted and it will take the better part of 20 years to reconstitute.
Just very briefly, I do agree with the ambassador. I do think the Russian military has been very badly damaged, but I am concerned that people think they're zero. If you look at Russian history, they usually do horribly in the beginning of war, and then they learn and they get better. And of course, they have nuclear weapons. And they have other weapons. I'm afraid that the Europeans will think, you know what? We're only concerned about Russia. They're on the ropes. Ergo, we don't have to do any defense spending. And that would be catastrophic, I think, because they need to replenish their inventory, but also it sent a terrible message around the world, and it sent a terrible message to American taxpayers. That's more in your belly there. When we talk about replenishment, we've been talking about equipment and so forth, but the U.S. military right now is in a recruiting crisis. And it's partly because the studies show that an increasing number of young Americans in the 18 to 24 can't meet the minimum requirements. It's gone from 71 to 77% can't meet the minimum requirements. But I don't even think that's the worst. The most disturbing thing, and I had this in a blog post I wrote for Veterans Day, was at Quinnipiac University poll from last March. And the question they asked is, if you were in the same situation as the Ukrainians, would you stay and fight or flee the country? The plurality of young Americans said they would flee the country. 48% said they'd flee the country, and 45% said they would stay there. I think that's very concerning. I don't know what the answer to it really is, except to say that we've got to figure this out. And just one last thing on the defense budget. If you look at the numbers, how badly inflation has impacted that budget, we do have enough money in this. This country is wealthy enough to both help the Ukrainians, make sure Taiwan, we can do it all. But I think we need some leadership at the top to plainly to speak to the American people and lead the American people to realize that this is what we have to do. And some of these things are very expensive. You know, we have a United States Air Force today that the average combat airplane is 30 years old. We're planning on flying B-52s until they're 100 years old. I have students who do. Their parents won't let them drive across country in a 20-year-old car, let them fly a combat mission in an 80- or 90-year-old airplane. So it's expensive, but the alternative is completely unacceptable.
I certainly take the point on the nuclear weapons use that the Russians have threatened. My own view was there were plenty, and there are plenty of other steps along the escalation ladder before they get to nuclear weapons. I believe that the saber rattling was primarily to talk to the West, to get the West to try and put pressure on Zelensky to enter into early negotiations. And I think he's sort of backed off. He's at least stated publicly he's not going to use the nuclear weapons. Not that we can trust him, but I think he's learned a little bit from the international reaction. I suspect the Indians and the Chinese also said this is a great way to knock us off or out of your camp, or in India's case, off the fence. You will lose diplomatic support all over the country. So I take the point that Russia will still be formidable in the sense that they have nuclear weapons, and that's an unfortunate message that's been sent to North Korea and Iran and others around the globe. But I think that the Russians know that that would be a long way to go. So what are they doing instead? They're working up the escalation ladder in other ways. They did the partial mobilization some weeks ago. They have stepped up attacks on critical infrastructure. The Russians, of course, are the ones, no matter what you hear after hours on certain news channels, the Russians were the ones that blew up the Nord Stream 2 pipeline. I think they would also engage in other cyber attacks to try and take out other critical infrastructure within Europe. I think that they might also try to fully mobilize their war, their population, and get further on a war footing. So in other words, I think there are many, many other things that they'll do along an escalation ladder before they'll use nukes, but I wouldn't rule it out because he could get desperate in the end.
Well, great. Well, I have one or two questions, and then I think the audience, there are microphones there. If you want to line up, I'm happy to call on you next, or a lot of people interested. So let me throw out one question. One thing that's always been very interesting to me about foreign policy, international relations, is how linked together countries and regions are. When one domino falls one way or the other, implications that has for so many other parts of the world. The best example I can give recently is that I traveled to Moldova last month to help train Moldovan judges on intellectual property law, part of a U.S.-sponsored program to bring sort of Western business and legal practices to emerging democracies and emerging economies. Had Ukraine fallen within weeks, the Moldovans would not have been worried about trademarks and copyrights. They're much more worried about the Russians invading. So this is an open-ended question. You all touched on this to some degree, but suppose this war continues for 6 months, another year, another 2 years, but ultimately Ukraine prevails in some manner, Russians pull out, there's some negotiated end to the war. What are the implications in that scenario for Russia, for Ukraine, for other former Soviet countries, China and Iran, the United States, foreign policy or domestic policy, and more broadly, international law norms and customs? It's quite a broad topic, but does anyone want to touch on any of those topics of what the future might look like in that scenario?
I'll start off, I'm sure, Louis. So, I mean, I think one way to look at this war is, you know, Putin seems to believe that Russia is the exception to every other empire that's existed, which rises and then falls, and that Russia, in his view, is perpetually an empire and has a right to dominate its neighbors. If, Ukraine were able to prevail, you know, we can think about this maybe like the French last stand in the Algerian war, something like that. It would force, presumably, the next generation of Russian leaders to accept that, you know, it's over. The Russian Empire collapsed in 1917, the Soviet Union collapsed, and now Russia will still be the largest country in the world, and it's going to have to exist within its own borders. And that would have tremendous implications for its neighbors, because they wouldn't have to worry about Russia trying to undermine them. You were in Moldova. I'm sure you saw how the Russia in so many different ways tries to undermine, particularly this pro-European government in Moldova. So that would be, it would be very important. And I think for China, I think Russia will still emerge from this, you know, the junior partner of China and dependent on China. So I'm not sure that, I think it would be more dependent on China, and it would emerge from this no longer as a great power in the way that it imagines itself as a great power, except it does have nuclear weapons. It's finished as an energy superpower. I mean, as a result of all of this, in the end, and what's happened in this in the last 9 months, it's not an energy superpower anymore. So, and for U.S.-Russian relations, I think that would depend on what Putin's successors are like, you know, whether they in fact have given up his imperial dreams, or whether you have a more pragmatic group of people there that understands that it's in their interest to have a less confrontational relationship with the West, but we're not there yet.
Three points on that. First is Ukraine must prevail. We can't allow it to be otherwise. Whether that means dislodging Russia completely from Crimea or some ultimate negotiated outcome. One thing that is happening, which is incredibly positive with respect to NATO, is the increasing assertiveness of the Central and East European nations. And if you don't follow Kati Kallas, the Estonian Prime Minister, you really should on Twitter. She is a rock star. And the Estonians have long understood what a menace the Russian bear is. Buga was a wake-up call. In fact, the Estonian Defense Minister told me that were that to happen to a country, a tiny little country the size of Estonia, there would be no Estonia after such a short period of time. So they get it, and they're increasingly vocal. They are putting their money where their mouth is. They're all hitting the 2% GDP or better expenditure marks, unlike the deadbeat Germans. That's positive. Point number two, the final point here. The Chinese are watching this incredibly closely, and they are reducing everything to a math problem. And when it comes to particularly the fecklessness of our sanctions, that is sending all the wrong signals to Beijing. So we need to get the sanctions right. And we're not going to change Russian culture. I mean, I'm sitting next to the former NIO who knows the Russians better than I, but there's something deeply broken in the Russian culture. But we can at least leave them with a shattered economy and a more than decimated military so that when the crisis over time occurs, and it will occur, we have far less concern and consideration for what the Russians might be up to.
Just real quickly, what I'm concerned about if the Russians collapse, we need to have a plan to do something about the nuclear weapon inventory. Otherwise, we're going to have thousands of nuclear weapons in a disintegrating state. Secondly, I'm also concerned about proliferation. back in 2014, when Crimea was invaded, I remember those Ukrainian legislators said, you know, nobody attacks a country with nuclear weapons. Not quite true in Pakistan. And they were autarkic nuclear weapons. They mined uranium, they built missiles, they had missile bases, they had the whole nine yards. So I think other countries, you might think, who have the capability to do it, might think that they need to do it. And I do want to see Russia soundly defeated. I love that analogy to France and Algeria. So you can see that it can happen to a country that they can change their whole thinking. But I'm also worried about the Versailles Treaty. You know, if you humiliate, Russians have this, you all know better than I do, you seem to have this humiliation chip on their shoulder. That they, kind of like the Chinese, that they think they've been humiliated in the world environment, and that you don't want to leave them planning again, because there are other weapons out there. There are biological weapons now, CRISPR, where you alter DNA, can have terrifying effects. And we have a scientific infrastructure, which Russia does have. You know, the potential is there for, I think we need to, I don't know that we want to have Russians start an industry. I do know that we want to see Russia suddenly defeated. Not demilitarized, de-offensive militarized, or whatever word that might be.
Just on how does this end, we at my firm do this for clients, is it going to be a Russian victory, Ukraine victory, or a coup, or what? I think increasingly you're looking towards a negotiated solution, and the big issue is Crimea. The administration signals, at least privately and arguably publicly, something to the effect of Vladimir Putin sees Crimea as Russian as St. Petersburg. And then there's a little hint that means he might use nuclear weapons to defend Crimea. So that's the debate. I think you all follow this closely as I do. But when they talk about, is it good enough to go to the February 24th lines, or do the Ukrainians feel like they need to take Crimea? I think that is where Ukraine and the Europeans and the Biden administration, that's the path of divergence. I think the Europeans whose instincts were terrible at first, which were let's get over there and try and get in the middle of this and negotiate a settlement, I think Macron and even Scholz have realized that that is fruitless and ridiculous at this stage of the game. But as the Ukrainians continue to pick up momentum and potentially march south closer and closer to Crimea, that's the point at which you might have a divergence between the two. And so I would look towards that in 2023 as a possible negotiating point where the West starts to put pressure on Ukraine.
Okay, so we have a little more than 20 minutes for audience questions. I'm just going to say, despite the very poor example I set with the open-ended and long-winded questions, I hope yours will be neither long-winded nor as open. So I reserve the right to cut you off, but with that, we'll start here with the first question.
I'm not sure the microphone is on. That's a little better.
Maybe it's the first day. Not in worse than you, I was wondering if the panelists' reaction that a opportunity to this in a similar life status, the risk of on the United States and your Korea, during the main revolution, put the policy of frequently or co-Russian
Well, I will start off. You know, the Ukrainian people twice, at least in 2004 and in 2013-14, you know, rebelled against what they saw as a corrupt, you know, a venal government, and particularly in Mr. Yanukovych's case when, you know, he was negotiating with the European Union and then sort of decided that he wasn't interested in signing an agreement with them. These movements are indigenous. And I think to say the United States is somehow responsible for them is just wrong. I mean, that's what the Russians want to say. But yes, it's true that when the people were out on the streets, there were clearly Biden official administration officials there supporting their right to protest. But I don't think that this is, you know, the cause of what happened. And I think, you know, we should really see this much more as something that was the initiative of the Ukrainian people themselves.
Anyone else? Sir?
Strongly agree.
This side.
Jonathan Richards from North Carolina. This question is for the whole panel, but specifically for General Dunlap and Ambassador Billingsley. And I do want to preface this, like General Dunlap did, saying that I am in full support of doing whatever we need to do to ensure that Ukraine is victorious against the aggression from Russia. However, over the course of the United States and many of our allies helping Ukraine, we have ignored and in some cases blatantly violated international law with some of the ways that we've helped. And will there be consequences, not for this conflict necessarily, but for the next conflict and for future conflicts, of trying to hold on to a maybe not necessarily moral but legal high ground that we really can't stand on while at the same time demonizing our adversary?
Yeah, we do have to hold the legal and moral high ground. I think we all know right after 9/11, the entire world was backing us. And then we had things like Abercrombie and so forth, and a lot of that eroded. I think what you're referring to is the law of neutrality. Law of neutrality did say, traditionally, that you could not aid a country one side of a belligerency. Since then, there's been a movement in, I mean, literally this year. If you had asked almost every international lawyer 2 years ago, they would have said, no, if you're a neutral, you can't aid one side or another. There's been an advancement of something that's called qualified neutrality. And I hark back to Justice Jackson's opinion in the Lend-Lease case, where if a country is the victim of aggression, ergo, you can do things that you would not otherwise be able to do. I think that there are going to be consequences of the abandonment of the traditional view of neutrality. I'm not exactly sure what they're going to be. For example, neutrality in the law of the sea is very important. And so, and this isn't exactly the same thing, but the erosion of the law of neutrality is a concern. And I don't know how it's going to play out. And I want the qualified neutrality argument goes to the idea that of collective self-defense under Article 51 of the UN Charter, that you can go to someone else's defense and it doesn't necessarily make you a co-belligerent. That's what the argument is. I'm not so sure that's true, but we are where we are, and the international community seems to be accepting this idea of qualified neutrality, but what its effect in the future is, it remains to be seen.
I think it might be very interesting if you go back and look at the now declassified finding that supported the Reagan administration's arming of the Mujahideen. It's well-reasoned. It makes clear that the furnishing of military equipment does not make you a co-belligerent. And I'll just leave it at that. I'm unaware of any violations by the Biden administration of international law in this respect.
Yeah, the law of neutrality and the law of co-belligerency are actually separate. You can violate the law of neutrality and not necessarily be a co-belligerent. So it is complicated, and there's a case called Nicaragua from the International Court of Justice, which would suggest that there are lots of things a country can do, including arms and money. Where it gets tricky is when you're providing like real-time intelligence and things like that, and certain other kinds of activities, it gets tricky. So more to follow. Great question, but more to follow on that.
Thank you, Paul Kamner. Professor said real quick, you mentioned the 1994 Budapest memo, the US, UK, Russia agreed to give assurances for the territorial integrity. Obviously, that was violated by Russia. Now, that's not as good as having Ukraine joining NATO. And when you talk about the reasons for the invasion by Russia, you talk about it's going to give back to greater Russia, et cetera. So, my question is to you. Before they invaded Ukraine, they said, hey, if Ukraine were to our square against joining NATO, we would attack. Of course, they didn't do that as the expansion in Central Europe. Do you think that even if they did, Russia would still invade because of this large issue of going back to the greater Russia? And a real quick question to General Dunlap, thank you for your service as well, Veterans Day, as former Army officer, and had general support, not yet. A lot of us, we don't need free cash, bitch. What are the prospects of international criminal courts doing anything about the war crimes? And two, my understanding of the War Crimes Act in the United States can be jurisdiction that the victim is a U.S. national. Therefore, if there is a Ukrainian citizen as dual national nationality, would that be the basis of jurisdiction?
So just quickly on the NATO question. So under the Yanukovych government, Mr. Yanukovych said that, you know, Ukraine will remain a neutral country and doesn't seek NATO membership. Of course, we know what happened to that. He fled the country, and then the Russians did invade in 2014. They took Crimea, and they started a war in the Donbas. For the Kremlin, NATO was an obstacle, because had Ukraine being a member of NATO, then Russia really wouldn't have been invaded Ukraine. So if your goal is to take over Ukraine, then clearly NATO membership would be an obstacle. But I think a lot of this is a red herring. And I think that probably even if Ukraine had forsworn joining NATO, I think probably Putin would still have invaded, because it was his goal to take over the country.
Yeah, I agree with that. In terms of the War Crimes Act, yes, if a U.S. person is a victim, you could jurisdiction. But on the other hand, if a U.S. person is murdered by anybody, you can find jurisdiction for it. And the 1994 Budapest, I think that the U.S. government's position is that wasn't a treaty. So the U.S. government wasn't bound to executive agreement. The ICC, they've opened an investigation in Ukraine. It's funny, because Ukraine isn't actually a party to it, but they agreed to jurisdiction. They don't have a good track record. I think they've been around for 20 years, and they spent a couple billion dollars. I think they have 10 convictions, all of people in sub-Saharan, 10 or 12 convictions in sub-Saharan Africa. It's a possibility, but they will be looking at war crimes on both sides. So I think I'm personally in favor of an ad hoc tribunal that involves the Ukrainians, has international participation, very transparent. And I think that they ought to start out anyway with what I would consider the very obvious cases in Bukha. You know, some people say, well, you know, don't get distracted with small players. Well, let's get started. And I think it's better than the Ukrainians doing it themselves in their own courts. I think an ad hoc tribunal would be, and we have the International Criminal Tribunal for former Yugoslavia, it's a big success, I think. So, you know, that had UN support, but I think that something could be constructive.
We're not done, but I have a couple of announcements to read, so I'm going to get one of them out of the way. If you're pursuing CLE and this is your last panel of the day, please be sure to check out by scanning your QR code when you came in. Next question's over here.
Hey, thank you guys for being here. Appreciate your thoughts. My name is Will McGee. I'm a law student at Yale. My question is, you know, over the last 30 to 50 years, we've seen a loss of expertise within the defense industrial base, as well as a real loss of the capability to field, you know, a major acquisitions program, thinking like an ACOT level one system. When you look at the LCS program, for example, the F-35, thinking 10 years ago during the Libya campaign, Europeans ran out of munitions within the first 2 weeks of the war. Now we're hearing similar things from our own defense industrial base, as you guys mentioned, about the ability to produce howitzer shells, one of the most, you know, commonly used munitions in a conventional campaign. Given that the Ukraine war now has almost put the idea of a conventional maneuver campaign back on the map in terms of something the U.S. military might be required to do for an extended period of time, do you see any chances for any sort of acquisitions reform or ability to improve the acquisitions process to prepare for the next campaign?
I mean, now, I was in the military for 35 years, acquisition. Every year, we're going to do acquisition. And it's very hard to get done because part of the burden in the acquisition process is somebody does something crazy one time, so they put another rule in that, you know, makes it more burdensome. I think that there's, in the high-tech area, there's a lot of activity. But the other part of the problem is there aren't many companies that can build the kind of high-tech weapons that we need. I remember when we went out for the bomb, when we were bidding for the tanker, there's like two or three countries in the world that can build an aerial tanker. I mean, others could, I guess, from scratch, but we're kind of in that business. And in some instances, there's really only one option. So acquisition reform would be great. I don't know.
Well, just on the defense industrial base, this has been a concern even before Russia-Ukraine, because people are trying to look at how long would it take to have a 455-foot ship navy to take on the Chinese, and all inquiries end in total frustration as you won't come anywhere close to it. But with this and the looming need to do a true pivot to Asia and arm the United States Navy with more ships and arm Taiwan, I think you'll see a renewed effort in the next Congress that'll start here in January. What are we going to do to enhance the defense industrial base? Because we're running out of arms to arm the Ukrainians, and we haven't even begun to deliver what we need to for Taiwan.
Also, thanks for your service, Marine. Two thoughts here on this. One is that rather than focusing on the ACAT-1 programs, because that's really not what's being used on the battlefield today by the Ukrainians, I think we need to focus more on either the loss of skills and know-how that will feature in future conflict with the Chinese, in particular, the erosion of our understanding of hypersonics. We were the world's leader in hypersonic development back in the 60s. We shelved those programs and we lost all the know-how. The Chinese did not. They were never bound by the INF Treaty, and therefore found themselves free to build and deploy thousands of medium-range missile systems, dual-capable ones as well, and in hypersonic tipped in some cases. So point number one here is the role of advanced missile in the medium range is something that we were prohibited from having due to the INF Treaty. We finally got out of it under the Trump administration. Russia was cheating. But that is a complete hole in our industrial base. And so when it comes to acquisition programs, we need to rapidly accelerate both the Army and the Marine Corps mid-course systems, which are designed to provide road mobile sort of containerized missile solutions. We're going to need that for China. Point number two, drones. Okay, we're only seeing the beginnings of drone warfare here. We got a taste of it with what the Azeris did to the Armenians, and we've now seen what both sides are able to do to one another with the Bakhtiar Turkish drones and now the Iranian supplied drones from the Russians. Our counter drone capabilities are greatly lacking, and that is another major area where we need to accelerate.
Thank you. I think back to this side.
Thank you.
Thank you.
school. And so, really, who do you call them? Who do you need to be aggressive in trying to meet the law? So, for instance, the scale of war crimes is pretty dramatic beyond those groups. So, now we have a place to demand people can
I wish we could prosecute him, but we'll never get there. And I think it's one of the first things we would deal away. Let's not take it off the table, but we would deal it away quickly if we were in some sort of setting. So I saw Bob Zelick's article about sort of painting a way to transfer their frozen assets to the Ukrainians, and it sounded terrific to me. I'm not really following up on all the legal blogs or other international lawyers who are commenting on it, but it read beautifully, and I hope we can do it to rebuild Ukraine. I think that's terrific.
Yeah, I'm where Michael is on the war crimes threat. I think it's very useful to have out there, but it's useful in the sense of trying to engineer distance between Putin and ultimately some of those who might displace him. When it comes to Russian sovereign funds that are currently blocked in the United States or Europe, I'm very cautious about going down that path of taking those funds and providing them directly to Ukrainians. I'm extremely supportive, however, of a package of measures that the Biden administration asked for back in March or April, which went nowhere on the Hill, which would greatly enable our ability to rapidly seize frozen oligarch assets and then furnish them to the Ukrainians. For instance, one of the sort of more important things that the Biden administration asked for, which we currently cannot do today, is it's not a felony offense to possess assets that are proceeds of corrupt dealings with the Russian government. But if you were to make that so, and then you adopt some of the other measures they requested, that would be a way to move billions of dollars that are currently frozen but not seized.
Before I get to the last two questions, I have one more announcement. I promise this is the last one. But afterwards, the Barbara Olson Lecture is taking place at 5:00 upstairs in the Grand Ballroom, featuring Professor Richard Epstein, a longtime contributor to Federal Society. At 6:35, there is a taping of a live podcast, Law Talk with Richard Epstein and John Yoo. And at 7:30, there is the Federal Society Film Festival kicking off. And that'll be in the Chinese Room. Okay, here and then here. And if they can really short, then our short answers, we'll finish on time.
Hi, I'm Erica Maley from Virginia. You described at the outset how Putin believed that Zelensky was going to flee and the Russian army would roll right over Ukraine. And it seemed like at the very outset, a lot of people other than Putin also thought that was going to happen. So what explains why things went so differently? How has Ukraine performed so well? And conversely, why has the Russian army performed so badly?
Well, that's going to be studied for years in war college thesis that yet to be written. Innocent trees are going to die, the publish those things. But here's Dunlap's theory on that. The Russians were, Crimea was a very different place than where the Russians up by Kiev. Crimea had a lot of Russian heritage people there, and they had a pretty easy time. And I think they thought that was what was going to happen up in Kiev, because they really didn't plan for a major operation that they found themselves in. They lost most of their special forces. They figured they could take over the airport and a few other places, and boom, they'd be in charge. And it didn't work out that way with the Ukrainians. There's very much a lot more resistance than they expected. And then they found themselves facing the 25-country coalition, in essence, that was giving Ukraine every modern weapon in the inventory. So I think that's, I was one of those people that, number one, I didn't really think the Russians would invade, other than maybe down that land bridge. But when they did, I think they just really didn't plan. They thought it was going to be like Hungary, where they just bring in a tank army and people are intimidated and so forth. And that just didn't happen, because the Ukrainian people, especially in that area around Kiev, were much tougher and much more determined to preserve their freedom than what the Russians expected.
Sure, just two short things. The corruption that pervades all of Russian society had pervaded the military in a way which I don't think Putin understood. And a lot of other, and I don't think our own government really understood. And that is to say, a lot of the money that should have gone to training men, to modernizing the army, producing weapons, went into people's pockets. And this is why, we all overestimated, and maybe it's our tendency to do that. If you're planning in the government, we overestimated the prowess of the Russian army. And they've turned out, it's really been quite shocking to people to see how badly they have performed. So, and then I think the other thing is that the Russians themselves underestimated how the Ukrainian military had developed since 2014. We and other NATO allies have been training them, and the Russians probably thought, would be like it was when they were fighting in the Donbass then. So Putin, was given bad intelligence, I think, on all points.
Yeah. One of them.
Can I, do you mind? We're going to run out of time.
Just, they didn't follow their own doctrine. Mm-hmm. They sent tanks in without dismounted infantry, and they didn't anticipate the bombs. So, Gerasimov's doctrine is fantastic. It's brilliant, the mind armed doctrine. They didn't follow their own doctrine.
Last question.
Thank you very much. And that's from a lot of talk about the
Well, I would say, let's keep in mind, Afghans and Ukrainians are very different cultures for many different reasons. So, and also the kind of army that was built in Afghanistan was kind of modeled on ours, that depended on a lot of technology and so forth, that was not necessarily appropriate for that context. Ukraine is different. I think Ukrainian people have a different mindset. I think they're much more united than the Afghan people turned out to be. And I just think it will be different. But as the ambassador pointed out, and as I've read in the paper myself, the U.S. is very, I'm going to give a kudos to the Biden administration on this. They are very conscious of this. The Pentagon is very conscious. They've just deployed teams and so forth to try to track the equipment. Very hard to do in the middle of a war, but I think that the problem that you identified is one that they're very conscious of and are going to work pretty hard. And I think the Ukrainians have every motivation not to have that happen. So I'm cautiously optimistic.
Great. Well, I've attended many panels over the years. This is one of the most current and informative panels I've attended. So please join me in thanking you.